Hey guys, it's Candace.
And it's Elena.
And you're listening to Christians on Crime. Oh.
How dare you?
Just a little fun joke because of our last episode. It really ruffled some feathers.
It did.
You cannot hurt my feelings. I just want you to know.
Yeah.
You can't. You can hurt Lena's feelings probably, but I will shield her from the nastiness.
Yeah. It wasn't that bad. Like, it wasn't terrible. Like, it was only maybe two people out of several others that were pleased with what I had to say. So,
well, you know, the thing is we have the microphone. Mm-hmm. And so we're allowed to kind of weigh in on our thoughts.
Yeah.
Sometimes
we can have an opinion. Is that what you're saying?
We can have an opinion. Oh. That's true. We're not hurting anyone else. Yeah. That's the thing, is like, by talking about our beliefs, we are not hurting anyone else.
Mm-mm. And if we have hurt you, please tell us specifically.
How? Tell us how. Yeah, because I would never intentionally hurt people's feelings or mock anyone else's religion. I have friends of all different religions. I have atheist friends who don't even believe in God. So that doesn't bother me because I find all sorts of people interesting.
Right. And that's the beauty of having your own opinion, is that you can have your
own
opinion.
That's right.
And we can still love each other.
We can. Hmm. That's the cool thing about it.
Yeah.
When I grew up and I understood myself in my 30s.
Right.
Took me a long time to grow up. But I could really understand others. All my struggles, all my experiences that have made me who I am, it has really opened my eyes to what others must have gone through and how their experiences have shaped their beliefs and their lives. But if you're here because you want to listen to some true crime and you like Candace and Elena.
And you like our opinions.
You like our opinions. Which,
it's okay if you don't.
It's okay if you don't.
Yeah. Candace is feeling a little feisty today.
No, my kids beat me up today. They really looked at my face and said no, like 50 times. So.
Oh, Lord.
So I have some teenagers on my hands. Mm. Hazel was at school being an angel. And the twins were just, you know, the twins are out of preschool. Okay. They've been out of preschool since May 9th. Okay. I've been hanging on by a thread, trying to work, while these two little hellions
no,
run my house
no,
and tell me no. So
next time you need to call Aunt Lena.
I'm going to call the police next time. Can I press charges against my 4-year-old twins? Anyway, all right. This is going to be a 2-part episode. I got a little bit carried away, and while I could make this a very long episode, mm-hmm. I have found, just from feedback that I've heard from you guys, that you like things in a more, like, palatable, like, you prefer 2 shorter episodes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, so I'm going to give it to you in 2 shorter episodes. Because the information is very dense and it's very difficult. So today I chose a family annihilator case because we just got word last week that Alec Murdoch is getting his convictions overturned.
Wow, wow, wow.
He is in fact getting a new trial. Now, we kind of knew this was coming for a long time. I mean, ever since we discovered Becky Hill, the clerk of court had been making comments to the jury, and this was a really big issue back then. And we found this out right after the convictions, pretty much. So she was, you know, saying, oh, he's guilty of sin and just whatever she was saying. And the first we heard about it was that she had made a comment during deliberation, but Dick Poot, Dick Harpootlian, Dick Harpootlian, who's Alex's defense attorney, Dick Poot says that Becky had been making these comments throughout the duration. So
and
this
did
is
he show proof?
They have been him and Jim Griffin have been going on the opening of an envelope. I mean, they'll speak to anyone. They even talked to Crime that. Junkie.
Oh,
did
really?
You hear that?
No, I didn't.
Okay. They're even talking to True Crime Podcasts. Maybe I should throw my hat in the ring. What's true? I don't know. You know, I don't know whether or not she was saying things all along or if she said it the one time.
See, this is what gets me is when jurors speak out after the trial and then here's Becky writing a whole book and I wish people would keep their mouth shut after these trials.
It really, you're right. And I think that we're used to seeing some of the jurors come out of the woodwork and start talking about how deliberations went. And I think it's all grounds for appeals.
Absolutely.
I think it's all grounds for convictions being overturned. And it just opens up a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah, I really wish people wouldn't do that. I've always thought if I was ever a juror that if media reached out to me, I would say no thank you because I don't want to be any part of this kind of stuff.
Right. Exactly. So we don't know what she was saying and when. There's probably some truth in the middle there. But it really doesn't matter what we think because the Supreme Court of South Carolina, the highest court, has ruled 5-0. Unanimously, that his convictions be overturned, citing improper jury influence. I got a lot of, you know, comments on TikTok saying, well, everyone deserves a fair trial. And I agree.
For sure.
I knew that he had a really good chance at getting another trial because of what Becky did. And she pleaded guilty to the misconduct and tampering with the jury. So there's that.
Right.
But in the interest of getting my point across, which I will not keep to myself, but also in the interest of not getting in legal trouble, here's what I want to say. Why did Becky do it?
Yeah.
Why did she... Was she just flapping her gums or was it something else?
Like no self-control? Like, you know you're not supposed to say these kinds of things.
We sat through that trial. And even before that trial, I listened to the Murdoch Murders podcast. I listened to it years before. And we can thank Mandy Matney, the reporter, for blowing up that boat crash case. And that's really what led to Alec being put on trial, being investigated for all those financial crimes and being investigated for murdering his family. Mm. And that happened after all that reporting started. So he had financial victims who had lost hundreds of thousands of dollars to his crimes. There were some shady deaths associated with Alex, Gloria Satterfield, and Hakeem Pinckney. If you don't know that one, just look it up. And let's not forget that he was convicted by clear and convincing evidence that he murdered his wife and son. That man will do anything, screw over anyone, and kill anyone to keep his simulation going. So why did Becky make the comments to the jury?
Do you have an answer? Is this rhetorical?
No, it's not. Why did Becky make these comments to the jury? And Lena, just as I'm sitting there looking up some more details, just yesterday, Alex Murdoch filed a civil suit against Becky Hill.
Yes, I
saw. Which further bolsters my opinion that her little stunt was orchestrated.
I never even thought about that.
If you go back and look at all his other financial crimes, you will feel some whiplash because this is what he does. He orchestrates something, he benefits from it, and then he doubles down on it. So,
okay,
that's all I'll say about Becky Hill. But here's what scares me about him getting a new trial. It's not just a matter of retrying him with all the same evidence. This isn't a cut and paste situation. If you recall the first trial, there was lots in the pretrial hearings back and forth where evidence was being poo-pooed by the defense. They didn't want some of the evidence in. Getting a new trial opens up all the evidence again to being admitted and excluded. So there are chances that vital, important pieces of evidence that were included the first time around that were essential to his conviction, perhaps some of the data from his car, who knows? Dick Poot even says on his interview with Crime Junkie that he looks forward to fighting much of the evidence that was introduced the first time. But guess what, Dick Poot? The death penalty is back on the table.
It sure is.
So if we're going to start all over again, let's start all over again.
That is a whole nother level.
And I think the state ought to double down on that.
Yeah. I mean, even though this has been overturned, he still is convicted of his financial crimes. So he's still in prison.
Correct.
But he has the opportunity to appeal those and get out on, you know, early or whatever.
Yeah.
And so
now I don't know. I don't know which judge will be presiding over this new trial. I believe we had a very fair judge in the first trial, but who knows who will get the second time around, which is another huge thing I'm scared about because Alex Murdoch's relationships with the South Carolina court system is incestuous. According to Mark Tinsley, one of the attorneys that was a witness to his financial crimes in the first trial, and he's been an outspoken advocate of Alex's guilt. He said that in the Supreme Court proceedings, people were just saying, yeah, Alex this, Alex that. So all these judges, Supreme Court judges, were referring to him by his first name.
Yeah, first name basis.
First name basis. So likely they all know each other. He's got his hands in everybody's pockets, and it's just so corrupt. It's just so corrupt. And lastly, like Lena said, you might be wondering if he's about to get out of prison and go through the Chick-fil-A drive-through while he waits for a new trial. And that's really uncertain. He is, like Lena said, he's got all these financial crimes that he's being charged with, has been convicted of some, has admitted to some. Mm-hmm. So I think they're going to make him sit tight. Plus, he's a huge flight risk. Are you kidding me?
Oh, yeah.
If he gets out, he's...
No telling what he's capable of.
And he's got so many people that would get him gone.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, I'll keep you guys updated. You know I'm going to be covering the next trial like I did the first. And here we go again. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so I chose today's case. I had actually started working on this maybe last year, and I kind of put it aside. But I thought, you know what? Let's go. This was a very infamous case back in the 70s, and while I've heard about it, I didn't really know all the details, but I'm sure our parents probably remember it pretty well. So December 7th, 1971, a woman living on Hillside Avenue in Westfield, New Jersey, called the police to request a welfare check at her neighbor's house. The family lived at 431 Hillside Avenue, and they hadn't been seen or heard from in weeks. Those close to the List family, who you'll learn is not a ton, knew that the family had gone out of town to visit a sick relative in North Carolina, but no one had expected them to be gone this long. I mean, it had been weeks. The caller explained to the dispatcher that it really wasn't the length of time that they had been gone. it was more like the lights on in the house that was kind of weird. There was lights left on, but there was no movement inside.
Nobody coming in or out.
No. I want to mention one more thing about the lights, not to beat a dead horse, but the reporting about the lights in the home comes from neighbors' testimonies. It seems like when the family left, many lights were left on, you know, to deter break-ins or what have you. But one man told police that he saw some light bulbs burning out. Like there were lights in this, that, and the other bedroom. And then he saw them go out and they were never turned back on. So I don't know if he saw them, you know, like a flash. I mean,
flicker.
We're talking about 1970s light bulbs, right? They're not LEDs. They're not lasting all this time. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if he walked by and like saw some go out, but it's just that's interesting.
That's pretty specific. Like you could have just been like someone turning off the, you know, light switch.
But you know how when a light bulb goes out, it kind of pops, flickers, and flashes. Yeah. So maybe people saw that happening and they just thought it was weird that nobody was replacing those bulbs or turning the lights back on. Okay. But it was enough to cause concern. Other than the lights in the home, I'm sure the concerned neighbor who called police consulted with other neighbors before jumping straight to the worst case scenario, right? And as it turns out, no one else could remember seeing anyone take the trash out, grab the mail, or even walk past a window from the inside since the first week of November. And remember, it's now December 7th. And that was just weird.
Yeah.
It's just weird to never not see anyone. Gotta love a nosy neighbor. I swear. I say, as long as they're not up in your grill or messing you up in some kind of way, let them be. Okay? Because they're watching out. They're watching out for all the weirdness in the neighborhood.
Oh, yeah. My neighbors, they tell me everything that's going on.
I love it. I love it. I mean, I don't care if someone tells my neighbor, did you see old lady Van Wade walk out in her nightgown to get the mail? That doesn't bother me. At least you're watching.
Yeah.
You know, you're seeing what's going on. Anywho. When officers from the Westfield Police Department arrived at the stately white Victorian mansion with green shutters, Lena.
Oh, that sounds beautiful.
Oh, dream home. Shortly after 10 p.m., it looked like there were people home, so they began knocking. As one officer stood knocking at the door, calling out to the family, another one was sort of, you know, milling around on the porch, kind of looking in windows, listening for any movement, you know, seeing if they could hear someone run down the stairs to grab the door. They didn't see any shadows or any sign of anyone, but they could hear something. Music.
Oh.
Yeah. They're like, well, I think that's enough to go in. So when they stepped into the grand foyer, their blood turned to ice when they heard what sounded like funeral music playing over the intercom. It was hymns. It was a religious radio station playing through this sparsely furnished mansion, which made it feel like they had stepped into like a time warp or something.
Wow.
Yeah. So police made their way through the main floor, looking into rooms, calling out, making themselves known. But by the time they reached the back of the home and entered the ballroom, they could see for themselves why no one was answering back. Laid out on the floor, placed on top of sleeping bags, were four bodies that they could tell were already gone. They all had head wounds and were quickly determined to be the woman of the house, Helen List, 46 years old, her daughter, 16-year-old Patricia, and sons John, 15, and Frederick, 13. Police headed upstairs to the second floor and then the third floor apartment where they found another body, an elderly woman lying in the hallway. And like with the other bodies downstairs, there were bloody drag marks indicating that the bodies were moved after being killed.
Mm-hmm.
Officers upstairs noticed two pieces of toast still sitting in the toaster in this kitchenette of the old woman's apartment, making them wonder if maybe she was in the middle of making breakfast or if this had happened sometime in the morning. They weren't sure. Having conferred with the neighbors outside, they learned about the identity of the elderly woman, John List's 85-year-old mother, Alma, who had been living with them. In fact, neighbors had expressed concern that she may have been left behind, like, while the family left. That's one of the reasons they called a welfare check-in, because they thought, well, maybe they weren't supposed to be gone this long, and the poor old lady's by herself, and maybe she's turning lights on or forgetting to turn lights off. And so they were really worried about the old lady. But where was the patriarch of the family, John List? It was a huge house, so maybe they just hadn't found him yet, right? By now, detectives and whoever else had showed up to the crime scenes back in the 1970s, they were all there. Some photographing, some looking through drawers and cabinets, hoping for any indication as to how this happened, why this happened, and where was John? During the search, someone had opened a filing cabinet and found two handguns, an old, like 1918 or something like that. I didn't write it down, but it was an old 9mm and a .22 caliber revolver. Looked like they'd found the murder weapons, but they found something else in that drawer that they didn't anticipate. A 5-page confession letter.
What?
Written to Reverend Ray Winkle, the pastor of the Redeemer Lutheran Church, penned by John List himself.
Oh, no.
The letter was dated November 9th.
The last time neighbors remember seeing anybody.
November 9th, yes. And it detailed the events leading up to the homicides, the day of the homicides, and the reasons for why he did it. I've linked a video in the show notes that has the confession letter. I don't think they read the entire thing, but you can kind of get the gist of most of it. I am paraphrasing unless I otherwise use quotes. So here I go.
Okay.
Quote, "Dear Pastor Ray Winkle, I'm very sorry to have to add this additional burden to your work. I know that what has been done is wrong from all that I have been taught. I'm sure many will say, how can anyone do such a horrible thing? Mother is in the hallway in the attic. She was too heavy to move."
Oh.
End quote. The rest of this is paraphrasing. He explained that he wanted to save his family the embarrassment of the financial ruin that they had found themselves in, that they didn't know that they were in. Before having learned John List's background, investigators could surmise that he had very rigid ideals when it came to his religion. He pointed to the rules of his faith, making only a light gesture to the real world solutions of his predicament. He said, sure, we could have gone on welfare, but that means moving to like a not so ideal place and the kids wouldn't have liked it. Surely they would have been affected by that. Everything was going away. The mansion that they lived in would be foreclosed on. He wouldn't be able to support his family anymore. There was just no other way. Plus, he says his family was slipping away from God. He said his daughter, Patricia, wanted to be an actress. And he said, I don't know how that would have affected her Christianity, but I'm sure it wouldn't have helped. And his wife, Helen, had stopped going to church altogether. And he said that he knew that that was eventually going to affect the children's attendance in church. He thought, if I freeze them in time, if I just kill them right now, the way they are now, they'll all go to heaven and I'll save their souls.
Oh, wow. What a way to think. Like, instead of thinking, I want my family with me. I love my family. We can get through this together. That's a very interesting way to think. Whoa.
Right. Not my version of Christianity. But anyway, he closed the letter. He closed the letter by saying essentially that if it were any of these things, maybe they could have coped. Maybe they could have worked it out. But it all of them put together was just too much to come back from. So unlike many cases where the police step into this nightmare, this wasn't a case of whodunit. It was all spelled out.
Yeah.
who did it, why he did it. It was the matter of tracking him down.
So he explained everything he did, but he did not say where he went.
Oh, no. He didn't say where he went.
I'm going to go have a vacation.
And the issue here is that John had like a month head start on them.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he had his family. I read something interesting that the police were calling John a coward because out of all the plans he made, he never made any plans for anyone finding his family.
Yeah, that's, I wonder.
He never set up something so that they would be found. He just left them there.
And so that's what I'm sitting here thinking is like, I'm wondering if he's shocked that it's been a month and nobody's found him, or if he's even checking to see if his family has been found.
So we'll kind of go through why nobody was looking for them for a long time. But also, I think the weather had something to do with it. Mm. It was cold. I don't know this for sure, but I'm going to think a 1970s mansion in the north in New Jersey maybe had radiators and not central heating. I don't know that for sure.
Okay.
But there it was freezing when the police went inside, which probably slowed decomposition.
Sure. Yeah.
Quite a lot. Anyway, so John Sr. had shot all the members of his family in the head. However, his son John Jr. got it the worst. He had probably tried to flee or fight back because his body was riddled with 10 gunshot wounds, both to his head and his torso. Because the family car was not at the home, it was a seamless assumption to think that John had taken it on his way somewhere. And they ended up finding the family car later at a parking lot at JFK Airport.
Oh, okay.
In New York City. Great.
Yeah.
Awesome. Great. But the trail went cold there.
Of course it did.
Stone cold.
So no plane ticket in his name.
So we're going to talk about that.
Okay.
The short answer is no. There was a ticket in the window that was dated November 10th. So that was the day they presume that he started his new life or started on the run. But no other useful evidence to suggest where he might have gone. He had left everything behind. Now, you and I mean both you and I, Lena, and also the collective you and I, us and our listeners, would simply not take this course of action, okay? No matter how desperate we may become in our finances, there's just not an avenue to where killing our whole family seems like the solution.
It's really unimaginable.
It is. It's unimaginable. So why is this anyone's solution? Why was it John's? John List was raised in a very extremely religious household. The ideals were bent. They were, like I said, extremist. He was raised to abide by these strictures. He was very self-sufficient and he grew up to be quite an accomplished man, likely because of all of these rigid rules. He was an only child and much was made of his accomplishments as a kid. So he always had that reinforcement. Work hard, you get this, good job, keep going.
Mm-hmm.
Just before he turned 18, John was called to World War II. For 3 years, meanwhile earning his bachelor's, his master's degree in accounting, and then he was off to serve in the Korean War. You can clearly see that John wasn't the type to kind of pray about his next move. You know, he wasn't planning his next move. It was just on from one thing to the next to the next.
But it's not like he ran from his problems. It sounds like he was doing what needed to be
done. He was a very productive person. He was very pragmatic. He was very private and he just got stuff done. So while getting his affairs in order to serve in the Korean War, he met Helen, who had just lost her husband in the war. She had a daughter named Brenda, who John took in as his own. Not long after courting, Helen believed she might be pregnant. So the couple married in 1951. Premarital sex, okay. Killing everybody in your family?
Not okay.
That's okay, too.
It's not okay.
So it didn't seem to bother John when it turned out that Helen was not pregnant. They carried on. They started their life anyway. He'd already taken on Helen's daughter, Brenda, who sort of fades into the background here. I don't know where she was living at the time of the murders. I think she was old enough to be out on her own, and God bless her for that. Anyway, back to her mom, Helen. Helen had a secret that she never told her new husband.
Oh.
She had contracted syphilis from her first husband and had actually been hospitalized a couple times because it was spreading through her body.
Oh, no.
Yes. And during those days, it was common for the military to treat syphilis with malaria, believing that the malaria would kill off the syphilis and they could treat the malaria. And this worked sometimes.
Whoa.
Yeah. Isn't that weird? And by the way, I now know how to spell syphilis. Oh. It turns out that I didn't know how to spell it, which why would I need to know how to spell that?
I'm glad anyways, you're
but now
educated.
I know how to spell it.
Yeah.
So if anybody needs to know, if I'm ever in a spelling bee and syphilis comes up, I'm going on to the next
one.
Do
I need to use it in a sentence for you?
No. So this treatment, you know, malaria for syphilis worked sometimes. But unfortunately for Helen, the malaria worked its way through her system. She got better from the malaria, but it allowed the syphilis to spread through her body before eventually going dormant. Because apparently that happens. I don't know much about syphilis, but I know more about it now. Perhaps it was some of those ailments of the syphilis that presented as symptoms of pregnancy.
Oh.
And that's probably why she thought she was pregnant. Maybe John thought she was pregnant because there's like dizziness, nausea, some common effects. Maybe not. But Helen was dedicated to hiding her diagnosis from John. She actually insisted that they get married in Baltimore because Maryland was one of those states that did not require syphilis screening before marriage.
Oh, wow. So syphilis was probably really common, prevalent in that
because of the
time
war.
Frame.
Yeah, probably.
Ooh.
So a few years into their marriage, John and Helen began having children of their own while John worked as a clerk in the army and worked his way up the ladder in commerce before becoming the vice president of the First National Bank in New Jersey.
See, he's doing stuff like,
right.
How does it just flip?
Right. It was the best case scenario for this young family, the husband rising in the ranks to provide for his family, which is exactly what Helen wanted after losing the stability of her first husband. Mm. I always think about women back in that time period where, you know, they were conditioned to be housewives, essentially. You marry someone who will provide for you. You have the children. You provide for them. And here she is. She loses her husband in the war. She's got a child. And of course, she's looking for a new husband. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But things gradually changed because Helen began to drink as she had to cope with raising three children. Preach into the choir, Helen. Okay. Preach into the choir. It's wild. And the drinking did not help her syphilis, if you know what I'm saying. It actually made the symptoms worse.
Really?
So after working as an accountant for all those years, John was finally making just over $23,000 a year, which today would be like $250,000. In 1965, the family moved to Westfield, New Jersey, which was an affluent area. And this is when John purchased that beautiful mansion on Hillside Avenue. I saw some reports saying that he bought it for $50,000. I saw some reports saying he bought it for $90,000.
Whoa, I'll buy it for $90,000.
I mean,
these days.
Right. But whatever the case, he bought it for just under $1 million, which would have been today's money.
Gotcha.
The only way to make this house work financially was for him to mortgage every single penny.
What?
Ooh. There were 19 bedrooms. Saw some reports saying 18, some said 19. What's, tomato, tomato. Yeah.
Who needs a house?
It had
that
a ballroom. It had marble fireplaces. Oh, you're killing me. It had Tiffany skylights.
Oh.
And a featured third floor apartment where John's mother lived. I mean, dream. I'm going to post a picture of it because it is like my dream home. Daniel would never let me have a house like that because he would say it was haunted. So I was forced to build a brand new house that looked haunted. But the children began settling into their new schools. They were doing quite well to make friends. Patricia attended Westfield High School and was heavily involved in the drama club. She was really close to her drama instructor. In fact, he expected to receive a postcard from her while she was on her family vacation, this family vacation that John said that they were on. He expected to hear something from her because she had missed an audition coming up that she was really excited about. Even though her dad, John, had called the instructor and said, you know, she won't be attending auditions, we're going to be gone for a few weeks. When he didn't receive word from her at all, he sent a social worker to go by the house and check on her, but there was no answer at home. They just figured, you know, the family was still gone. Oh, that was 2 weeks into her being missing. So they were all dead in that house. Someone's knocking on the door.
You gotta love the effort of this teacher or this.
You know, I wonder if he had some kind of intuition because these kids were very, very sheltered. The only socializing they did was at church and school. And, you know, some teachers just have a sense for things.
Yeah, they tend to know kids pretty well.
That's right. And she really wanted to become an actress professionally, which says a lot about maybe this escapism that she maybe felt like it was easier to be someone else. And she just might have done that had she been given the chance to live and make her own decisions. She was friendly to everyone. One Halloween, she threw a party in the ballroom of their home, and it was the talk of the town. I'm picturing Casper.
Oh my
god. You know,
gosh.
Like whipstaff and the big party. And I'm picturing no furniture, like a couple red Solo cups. It wasn't because this party was so lavish. Like there was nothing amazing about this party. Nothing in particular happened. It was just weird that the List children were allowed to have people in their house.
Oh, in this beautiful big house.
That's why people, and when people came in, they were like, there was hardly any furniture, which was kind of weird. This massive house. There's like one couch. So Patricia's friends actually told authorities that she was absent from school a lot, quite a lot. And they believed that it was because her mom had her taking care of the household, cooking and cleaning and maintaining the home. No one really knew it at the time because Pat, as her friends called her, didn't talk about her life at home. In fact, she got very clammy when people would ask her about her home life or particularly her parents.
Uh-huh.
The boys, Frederick, Freddie, and John Jr. went to Roosevelt Junior High, which was just across the street from the only other place they were allowed to go, their church. The List family were Lutheran, attending church regularly. John even taught Sunday school. Boring. Oh my gosh, how I would fight my parents to deter going to his class. So when the family first moved in, a neighbor brought a pie over. This is the police are learning all this stuff now about this family. A neighbor brings a pie over and, you know, says, "Welcome to the neighborhood." And he tells police, you know, John said in a very unfriendly voice, like, "We don't care for socializing."
Oh, okay.
I'm not even sure if he took the pie.
Thank you, but no thank you.
Yeah. There was a doctor that lived next door to the List family. he didn't really find it odd that they weren't very social. I don't know this for sure, but I imagine some affluent areas, people kind of keep to themselves. They have their very busy lives. They're career-driven people, and they probably don't. Or maybe they're stuck up. I don't know what it is, but this particular doctor, you know, he said he saw John sometimes, he didn't other times. This doctor was probably working around the clock, on call, who knows? Mm. So he had his own life going on. But there were others that took note that they never saw Helen, ever. I mean, she was like a ghost living in that house.
Mm. Well, if she's drinking a lot, she probably just stays inside.
That's it. In fact, the woman across the street told police that she hadn't laid eyes on Helen in the 5 years they had lived there.
Oh.
They saw her when she moved in, and that was it. They didn't even know if she was still living there. And they weren't wrong, because Helen was sick all the time because of her dirty little secret and the way she chose to cope with it. Her syphilis had taken her right eyesight and had spread to her brain, and was furthermore complicating many other aspects of her health. It was becoming increasingly more and more difficult for her to remember things and perform household duties, which is likely why she had her daughter out of school so much. To help her with the house.
So by this time, do we know if she's told her husband why she's getting so sick, or?
So I didn't put it in my notes.
Oh, okay.
But I will insert it when I get there.
Okay. I'll wait.
Because I'm surprised I didn't put it in my notes. But anyway. Sometime before her death, Helen began to really stress out about money. She had no idea the extent of her situation. The economy was in a downward spiral. She could sense things were slipping. She was buying things that she shouldn't have bought. John was getting upset. She wasn't raised in the confines of an extremist religious environment like John was. I think she married John because she felt like it was a safety net. He had a moral compass. He was going to take care of her and provide for her. But she grew tired of his radical beliefs, shoving them down her throat, being chastised for not going to church because she was ill and in bed. She did not agree with his version of Christianity. With her declining health, the three children, friction with her husband, and don't start me on her relationship with her mother-in-law.
Oh, no.
Who she hated and who hated her. It all became too much for her to handle. And Helen had a nervous breakdown.
Oh, girl.
So I think this is where John found out about the syphilis. Because her nervous breakdown landed her in a mental health care facility at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital in New York City. And it was a private program, and it was very expensive.
Oh.
So the family were already living well above their means with this huge mortgage that they could barely afford. They were trying to fix it up because, you know, a lot of the house had seen better days. And so they felt like they're buying this huge estate for a great price, and they're going to eventually, you know, fix it up. Why do you need 19 bedrooms? I don't know. Maybe it was the clout of it all. Maybe it was because John had achieved the ultimate.
Just because you can
doesn't mean you should. I always think, you know, unless I won the lottery, unless I had that lump sum mm-hmm. in my hand, I couldn't even fathom taking out a millions and millions and millions of dollars mortgage. Like yeah. I would not sleep at night, you know?
Yeah. That's stressful in itself.
Yeah. So anyway, they're trying to buy furniture for this house. Like I said, it was sparsely furnished, even when they all died. And now they're faced with paying all these medical bills. Which leads me to John's calm, cool, and collected nervous breakdown. The one where he said, you know, I can't keep up with this anymore. They all have to go. Now, I told you the economy wasn't doing too hot. Well, John was let go from his VP job at the bank.
Oh, no.
That's right. He began working for a life insurance company in January of 1971. He was making half of what he was making at his old job, and things were looking very grim. With that vice president money, they were in shambles. They were not making ends meet. They were living above their means. Now he's making less than half of that. He had already taken out a second mortgage on his home when he was faced with paying all of Helen's medical bills and trying to keep food on the table. John now had to take out a third mortgage on the home.
Oh my gosh.
But it gets worse. That wasn't even covering the bills.
Well, and then you have all your kids that you have to take care of and feed and...
Right. School clothes and lunches and field day t-shirts.
Extracurricular activity. Well, did they get to do
photographs
that?
Every 5 seconds? Yeah. I'm just thinking about the things that I'm paying for in school.
Picture packages.
Yes, exactly. I said it got worse. Lena, his mother had a $200,000 savings account that was probably her nest egg, the thing she was going to pass down to her son. He starts skimming money out of there.
Oh, no.
He starts taking money from her bank account to cover his bills. The source materials available are unclear as to whether his mother knew he was stealing from her, but I'm going to say no. Mm-hmm. She was elderly. He was probably in charge of her accounts. She probably didn't need much. And he was doing all this under the sly. Like, well, he was being so shady.
She probably would have approved if he needed money. I mean, she lived with them. So surely, I mean, maybe. That's my assumption, I guess.
Yeah, right. But no one knew what dire financial straits this family was in. Not one person in that family knew. And according to the LA Times, he took out the last $2,000 in her bank account the day he fled.
Ooh.
So over an extended period of time, that's how long it had been going on, that he had been taking money from her account to keep his head above water. Now, I always like to mention, you know, discrepancies in the reporting, especially when I find it particularly important. Most reporting said that John was unemployed leading up to the murders. However, there were some outlets that explained that he was working as an independent insurance agent. You might think that's unemployed as well. I mean, well, you might think they're one and the same. Mm-hmm. He was having to go out and find clients. And so maybe he did have this money-making opportunity available to him, but he didn't have the personality for that. Mm. So whatever that position was doing him no good. He was making no money at it. Yet every morning, he put on his slacks and a tie. And while his family believed he was walking out that door to go to work every day, for all those months, he was actually going to the train station to read the newspaper.
I'm baffled.
He had dug a financial hole so deep that he hid with lies, and he knew that soon it was going to cave in.
And all this time he had on his hands, he's sitting here scheming up a That's plan. It.
Lena, he'd already phoned it in. He had already thrown in the towel. We see this so often with family annihilators. They'll keep up this facade for as long as they can until they come to the very end of their rope. And they think the only solution is to kill everyone. It's not to spare their family, like they say. It's to spare themselves. And that's where I'm going to leave you for part one. If you're a member of our Patreon, you can listen to both parts now. But we'll see the rest of you next week to talk about what John did to his family, how long he'd been planning for it, and how he got away with it for so long.
Mm-hmm. And where did he go? Like, I want to know all of it.
I want to know all of it, too.
Are you going to find out or wait till next week?
Will we find out?
Well, that was great. Let's keep going.
Let's do it.
Let's do it again.
Let's see about it again.
To be continued.
Bye-bye, guys. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Cousins on Crime. If you're enjoying the show, please rate and review wherever you listen and consider joining our Patreon for bonus episodes every month.
Follow us on Instagram and Facebook for case photos and to stay up to date with the latest C-on-C news. If you have a case suggestion or just want to tell us how cool we are, email us at cousinsoncrime@gmail.com.